Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to this week's El Arpa's podcast, El Arpa podcast. I made a mistake at the end of the last one by saying good book instead of good luck, and I've continued this trend in the introduction, but it is a sunny, beautiful day. Spring has finally started in this fair city. Regular listeners of the podcast might remember when I mentioned Laurie Lee when I was flying solo on the podcast when Mary was in Egypt. He's a chapter about how, you know, when spring first stirs, you're kind of like uncomfortable. It's like, you know, something is happening, but you're not quite ready for it. But then suddenly spring wakes up and you wake up with it, and it just, everything clicks. And today, my friends, is that day. Very beautifully written chapter as well. So it is. But next to me is the irrepressible and irreplaceable and irredeemable, irascible Mary, who is very tired and fatigued, but will power through heroically through this podcast. What have you been doing to make yourself so wrecked?
I'm not wrecked.
But you look great, though. Don't worry.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, I've been putting in the application. I'm consciously speaking loud because I knew I was very quiet. I couldn't hear myself last time.
Okay.
The application that you spoke about before to the listeners,
yeah,
that I told you not to say what it was about, and I'm still not gonna say what it is about.
That's okay. You concentrate on being louder and not tired, and don't worry about explaining applications.
I know, I'm making all the effort.
You've also been correcting essays from the United States. Now, this is interesting to me because they keep kicking you out of the system. Letting you back in, though, so I don't know what their criteria is. Maybe you can shed some light. And also, but I'm sure you're very competent.
Of course.
And John Oliver, in one of his very first shows, actually, on his show last week tonight, one of his very first stories was actually about these companies that do advertising, or not advertising, but exams for schools, because they outsource it to companies, and I believe these are the ones that you are actually correcting. So he had a very critical view of them. But this is like 2 or 3 years ago. But you showed me a picture of one yesterday. These are kids mostly writing in Spanish, or are you also correcting English essays?
No, only Spanish.
So the average American, what's the age bracket here?
13 and 15, something like that.
Okay, so they're relatively young. What are they writing about?
All sorts of subjects they can pick. They can talk about, normally it's either environmental issues or social issues, cultural things, that sort of thing. They have to pick a certain area.
Yeah.
And develop an original piece of writing.
Well, we were, as you mentioned, we were translating Mexican Spanish recently for a book of prayers. I guess most of the Spanish of these kids is going to be Mexican influenced or Latino influenced.
Sofia,
so, any interesting phrases? Any interesting words?
But sometimes like they use words, and I actually have to check whether they are words in like Mexican Spanish, because obviously like Mexican Spanish is very influenced by English.
Okay.
So I have to make sure that they're not making up words, just, you know, like the typical thing that English people say, oh, well, for Spanish, you just put a no at the end.
Yeah, well, there's a very, you know, Andy Gray, the disgraced former Sky pundit, he got sacked because there was a female assistant in the studio, and he used to do a show with Richard Keys, and this video emerged of him saying to a woman as she was, like, bending over next to him, "While you're down there, love." So very crude, and now he's exiled to the Middle East, working for maybe in Qatar, I don't know, with Richard Keys doing a football show. But there's a very famous anecdote of him as a footballer abroad, well, in Spain, on a pre-season tour perhaps, or maybe for another reason, and he said to a woman in the hotel, can you tell me where the fucking taxi AO is? Did you ever hear that story before?
No.
Yeah? So everything was English except for taxi, which is taxi AO. So where the fucking AO taxi AO is, or something like that. So,
so just the one word that was the same in Spanish.
Yeah.
Mocked up as well.
I know, yeah.
On top of everything.
So that's because you mentioned, you know, putting an O at the end of everything.
Yeah.
That is a very infamous example of a footballer abroad doing that in a very obnoxious and brutish way. So
I
there.
See. Yeah, no. Well, I mean that's always like the jokey way of doing it. But then, well, I have to double check because sometimes I don't know. I remember like there was like fontanero, for example, which is plumber, and in Spanish, Mexican Spanish, they call it plomero. But then when I read plomero, I'm thinking, okay, this guy has just put a no to the Spanish to the English word.
Sounds like they're taking the piso.
Yeah, the piece of the floor, the and then.
They're
You know,
Mickey you.
the apartment. And then I had to, yes, I just double checked, and then in the dictionary it said, like, you cannot see plomero, Mexican Spanish. I was like,
But
all
that's
right.
kind of generally what Latin American Spanish is like, because I know they, well, no, but
Some
yeah,
people will be pissed off about
well, I
that.
don't know, but like for example, like car is caro, no?
Yes, but that doesn't come from car, it comes from like carro, like a carriage.
Well, consider me corrected then.
Cart, yeah.
Okay, so the horseless
No, you're
carriage.
not corrected,
No. The politically correct is police
but
there.
grammar police.
The grammar police. Sorry, they're pulling up there. I must give them my license and registration. So, this has been a relatively light-hearted part one. In part two, we'll be talking a bit about some contemporary and more well, more sobering issues, but we shall say. So, join us in part two for that. And we'll take it from there. Part two of the show, here we are. So, as suggested or as said in part one, this is the. Well, we take a look at some current affairs, political news. A lot of things to talk about. Some of it will be a bit more lighthearted than others. But we'll just dig into the nitty-gritty of it all. So you mentioned to me yesterday we were talking about Enoch Powell, as this is in the newspapers at the moment. Can you just give us some background into what this story is at the moment?
Okay, well, the story that has been all over social media is that the BBC radio decided to broadcast his infamous speech from the 60s. Well, essentially a very racist speech calling to act against immigrants and so on.
Okay.
Ah, well, not only they decided to broadcast it, they decided to get an actor to read it out.
Yeah.
That's the thing as well.
Okay, so we both object to it, but can you go first and so I can steal your better ideas when dismantling it. But what is your primary objection to this?
Well, I think it's completely unnecessary, you know. I don't know, the people that think like it should be broadcast were arguing that people need to know what he says so that it cannot be repeated. But the fact is that people know what you know, people know what he said. I mean, people can know what he said if you Google it, if you YouTube it, you can find the original speech.
Of course.
You know, so there are many ways of like dealing with that. Because I think it's part of a series where they talk about different characters, different people in
Yeah.
20th century or something like that. And then, you know, you can really talk about it without actually giving voice to it. And what is worse, you know, is like actually getting somebody to read it.
Yeah.
To me, it's like completely, you know, giving it an importance that it doesn't deserve, you know,
To
and
play
giving a currency that.
it doesn't deserve. To
Yeah.
play devil's advocate or the
Okay.
devil's lawyer in Spanish
Okay.
or devil's liar or o in whatever you're correcting maybe in your essays.
Yeah.
But no, I mean the fact that it's part of a series does make sense. I mean every week they're talking about different aspects and if there's going to be a panel discussion before and after, I imagine that it will be picked apart quite well. And if you've listened to that part of the show, you shouldn't come away, but some people will, because and we'll get into why that is in a moment. Will you know? Some people will come away feeling more emboldened by it, but most people probably won't. And I know as well in historical circles that actors kind of like giving life to new speeches is kind of a done thing as well. It's just an unfortunate confluence of events because you have this series, you have this historical norm of having actors. Doing speeches to reenact them and to give them to a new audience at a time when Brexit is well it's still happening. It's been 2 years almost. It's another year of it to go before it's finally enacted. And we're seeing a succession of awful racism towards minorities and migrants there. And that's why it shouldn't be broadcast, probably, because you already have people who don't know the facts. We already have people who don't know the real situation involving migrants coming into Britain, for example, who are still swayed by empty and misleading and very factually wrong statements. And that was also the modus operandi of the writer of that speech, Powell, because he constructed his speeches very deliberately. Because he always wanted, and he's on record saying this, he always wanted a provocative statement in each speech so he could get the headlines, for example. And why did he want to do that? Because he was a careerist politician, like Boris Johnson is. And he, like Boris Johnson, regretted the shrinking of the British Empire and had a very particular view of what Britain should be. You know, and also he had an objective to lead the Conservative Party, and he was very unsuccessful as a career politician. But why he was deliberately making these shocking statements was because he had like a career objective in his mind. And why do we have Brexit? Because, well, David Cameron orchestrated the vote to keep his backbenchers happy and keep his hold on power. He obviously lost that, and you had career politicians like Theresa May. He'd let go of at different points, and Boris Johnson, and even Nigel Farage, you know, he's not part of the conversation that much anymore. You know, these are all careerist politicians who want just power, basically, but using, like Enoch Powell, misinformation to achieve their very tangible, very kind of like muddy, everyday power that they want, for example. And that's why you have a lot of people, like this week, going around attacking a Spanish woman on the bus for speaking Spanish. I'm not sure if you've seen that story, but that's happened. Mm-hmm. And that's why in The Guardian today you have profiles of people who've come from the Caribbean, who've been in Britain for 50 years maybe, who are being investigated, been almost deported, but for the intervention of a local councillor or MP, or for the Guardian newspaper, the Home Office has had to kind of backtrack and either delay the investigation, or, well, they haven't apologized in any case, or just drop it, for example. So there's all these nasty things happening because you have career politicians who don't believe the things that they're spouting, spreading this false information about migration and British history, for example. That's why I think it's very dangerous to show this speech now, because what he was trying to do back then is happening now with his modern equivalents, and is having very real consequences for people who've been paying taxes, contributing to the country for decades, and could be separated from their family or deported back to a country like Jamaica or Barbados, which they haven't been in since they were 8 years old, since they haven't been there since, like, you know, they were a kid for 50 years, for example. And also that also because, you know, this idea as well, like, because it's such a, I mean, if you look at Brexit, I mean, if you listen to James O'Brien, you can find his videos on YouTube. He has a radio show where he dismantles the kind of myths of Brexit. And, like, he shows how, in different situations, the Sun newspaper, which is a very pro-Brexit newspaper, they apologise, like, maybe 6 months after making a wild statement about Brexit. And nobody sees the apology, but obviously the lies they say and spread are front page news. And he's saying, this is how stupid they think you are. You know, if you're a Brexit voter, if you're a reader of the Sun, that you will won't even read the apology, or you won't put two and two together to make four. You just ignore it, and all the different headlines, you will pay attention to those. Okay, sorry for that interruption. Mary got a phone call because she has a desk being delivered to her. But anyway, that's just an aside. So people love this colourful stuff, but no, and also, you know, and I'll let you speak about this, because I know you have strong feelings about it as well, but the last point I'm going to make for now about this as well is that, like, if you're following the Brexit thing, you know, I've heard this so much, and it is absolute bollocks, basically. It's like how the Commonwealth can replace the European Union as a trading partner, even though they're not legally allowed to build trading links with any country until they leave officially the European Union. The Commonwealth, of course, are far more interested in maintaining ties with the European Union because it's a bigger market. And also, even though you have this Commonwealth, they're meeting very soon again for the first time in a long time. But it's never really been given the importance that perhaps Commonwealth members would have wanted in the past. And Britain's never really seen it as a proper thing, even though it existed in name and a little bit beyond that. So you know, I think it's a bit rich because, like, you have, as I mentioned, like people from the Caribbean and Jamaica who are being investigated by the Home Office now, but they're also countries that came because of the Commonwealth and Britain's history of colonization. There's a very famous Irish comedian who made a joke, Britain goes around the world and gets upset when people follow them home. And like, this is what's happened. This is the legacy of colonization, you know? And what also is, but like, they favor, so this is their big kind of like get out of jail free card to use the Commonwealth. But even within that dynamic, that kind of paradigm, they're focusing on Australia and New Zealand because they're white and quasi-European and culturally, in air quotes, more similar to us, for example. So even in this kind of like Hail Mary scenario of the Commonwealth curing everything, like the Africans and the non-white European people, or non-white people without European descent, are like second-tier, second-class partners in this, you know, bright supposedly future for post-Brexit Britain. So like, there's so much wrong happening, and I think it's a very dangerous time to air that speech because people should know better. Some people should know better because the facts are out there. It's very clear that a lot of what they're saying, especially about migration, is rubbish. But people will listen to that speech and probably extract some, you know, in air quotes, facts from it to support their kind of leanings, which are maybe a bit more racist and kind of, you know, digging into a myth of a past that never was, really, you know. So that's kind of my standpoint on the issue. Mary, please take over.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, well, the interesting thing that you were saying that, for example, Australia, New Zealand, like they focus on them because they're white. Well, but also like they're also neglecting people that are not white. You know what I mean? So it's like, yet again, it's like a misconception of that. What happens a lot with colonialism, anyway. And then it is what you said. I think it's like, you know, it's making a current in and also like thinking, well, okay, so look, this guy said this like 40 years ago or 50 years ago, and he was right. Look, because, you know, he said that all these people were gonna come and take over the place, and this is what's happening. You know, thank God that we're on this route and
Like, I mean,
hopefully continue on this route.
for anybody with sense, like, to hear a speech would shock you because, because you know, statements that are being made today about how foreign workers should be on some kind of register, how foreign doctors and nurses should be banned from coming into the country, you know, all these kind of very serious statements wouldn't look out of place in the Powell speech, you know, even though we associate Powell speech, well, some of us do, with something horrid, while perhaps certain statements from current Tories might get something of a free pass, you know. But again, because some people can't see what's in front of them, that's why it's dangerous to air that speech.
And also, like, you know more about like media, how media works than I do. I don't understand what the need is to, I mean, if they're so interested, why can they not like broadcast the original speech, which also like, you know, even the sound and everything will highlight is an old thing. Do you know what I mean?
Well, actually,
Why does it need to be reenacted?
well, like, you know, the BBC are, I think, gets a lot of flack, but as I mentioned in the previous podcast, their World Service, I was going to say World Series, they're not baseball players, their World Service and their podcasts are genuinely fantastic. I don't watch enough BBC to know, but like, you know what their television output is like. But you know, Panorama, for example, they do investigative programs. But if I was BBC now, I would be keeping my head maybe a little bit like below the parapet in certain respects. They have to be brave and do their job and report things. But you know, some people think the BBC didn't do a good job in stopping Brexit. And for those who do support Brexit, they see the BBC as an organ of the elite that they hate so much, for example. So like, who is their target audience with that show? I mean, I guess they want to get, well, not clicks, but listens, because, you know, people will be tuning in on both sides of the Brexit divide. But I don't think there's going to be any long-term gain for the BBC in broadcasting it again and bringing it back to life.
Well, it's not as if they need listens, you know what I
Well,
mean?
because
Like, they're a public service. It's not as if like nobody knows them, and they know, it's not like the song wanting to sell newspapers.
Exactly, yeah.
Really,
Yeah.
so there's no need to cause controversies
Yeah.
there.
Well, I guess it's current, so maybe that's why they're doing it, for example. But,
But what is current?
well, I mean, Brexit's current, so. And
Yeah,
this.
but this has nothing to do with Brexit.
Well, we've just been talking about the last 10 minutes of how it is.
No, but I mean, like, it shouldn't do. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it shouldn't,
Like,
but it is, though.
well, okay, but that's what I mean. Like, why? It's not as if you're saying, I mean, by bringing it up, you're legitimating that association. That's what I mean. If it's not, if it, there's nothing particular that should bring it up at the moment, other than, I don't know, a series on like controversial speeches of the 20th century or something like that,
Yeah.
which might be the case, I don't know.
Yeah.
Next person in the program is Stephen Lawrence.
Yeah. Is the next person Stephen Lawrence? Okay, that's interesting. Because that is a long, what, 25 years, is it 27 years? I think it's around that time frame. It's a quarter of a century. But that's a big case. Yeah, that's, which is linked, isn't it? I mean, because he was a black man profiled by the police, and this, well, institutional racism, where does it come from? Does it come from colonization, immigrants coming to the country, a certain section not liking that? Does that transfer into the offices of power through police officers, for example, when they're doing their job? It's hard to know where exactly it comes from, but I think thematically it can be linked. And if you've been following the news, in Philadelphia, two black men were arrested in Starbucks yesterday or over the weekend because they're waiting for a friend, like we all do. You go in there, you get a table, your friend's late, you don't order yet, and then when the friend comes, he sees them being let out by police officers because the people behind the bar in Starbucks or behind the counter called the police because they didn't like the cut of two black men sitting there doing nothing. So they mentioned that famous comedian before, the Irish comedian. He actually has a joke about that as well. Like, it's like, why do they try to ban loitering? That's a law against doing nothing, so they don't trust people when they don't do anything, but especially if they're of a certain kind of background as well. So here as well.
Well, the loitering thing, if it's like a slightly big group that is like eight people or more,
Yeah.
then it's the same as like with Ley Mordaza.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah.
You know, it's.
So the next episode is Stephen R. So
Well, this is what this is the latest thing that I read, that I don't know if this was already like a decision made before or,
neither
you
do I,
know,
but I've read the same thing as well. So
before or after the polemic,
that should
so.
be an interesting book. Well, it's funny because like a lot of these things actually are connected as well, because you mentioned Spain. There's a trial in the Basque Country. We won't speak too much about this, but basically, there's a big pub fight maybe 8 years ago, and they're being done. Well, the government tried to do them for terrorism charges, which seems very excessive. Also, there's a story that emerged last week in France where this, like, well, under the Sarkozy government, conservative government, and also the conservative media kind of helping him out, they planted a story about how this kind of socialist anarchist terrorist group were in operation. So there's a very famous story of like 100 or 100 plus police officers raiding this small sleepy French village and arresting them. Took around 8 years as well, I think, for that to be finally done and dusted with, which was like last week, where the judge basically said like they weren't terrorists, but it kind of shows how the kind of state attack like left-wing people. I'm not saying that every left-wing person is justified, but and why I'm saying that as well, because I want to talk about this kind of circles back to the Stephen Lawrence thing as well, because like how, like I mentioned this story to you before, because I bought a book that was written by the Guardian, some Guardian journalists, about undercover police operations in the British police. Now, they did this in Northern Ireland as well, but they did this also against British citizens, like infiltrating Greenpeace and kind of like university groups that were like pro-environment or pro-sexual, like equality or gender equality, and basically in some cases doing very bad things. And in that case, the French story as well, there was a former English spy who infiltrated the group as well, for example. So like all these kind of things that are coming out now, they're all linked by, well, the state not trusting their people in a way, infiltrating different groups as well, and in the case of Stephen Lawrence, sometimes doing very bad things to them as well, with fatal consequences. So that's a little bit of an aside, even though our main focus so far has been the Enoch Powell speech. So I guess you also want to talk about Syria. Moving on to happier subjects.
Yes, yeah.
So a lot has happened as well. So obviously I have my thoughts on that, which I will give, but I will defer to our Middle Eastern expert, which is...
Oh, no, it's hard.
But like, yeah, just take it whatever way you want.
No, it's just, well, I don't know. It's another, like, talking about, like, controversies that have been this week, you know? And then when you start reading, like, some people say, well, the same way as we said about the speech, some people say, oh, well, like, you know, there was this chemical attack and it had to be stopped and so on. And so the people say, well, wait a minute, many things have happened before and then nothing has been done, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah,
Or.
this is humanitarian
And also,
justification.
is the solution, you know? It's a solution for people being killed, launching an attack that will kill more people, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
It's.
Well, I mentioned Jeremy Corbyn was on Andrew Marr the other
Oh,
day
yes.
on the BBC, I think, actually. Bizarre line of questioning, I have to say. I know you haven't seen the clip, but like historically, Jeremy Corbyn has never voted for missiles to be fired. Now,
Sure.
most times it's probably wrong. I mean, you've had air raids in the Balkans. People like Noam Chomsky, for example, during the not the Baltics, sorry, but during the breakup of Yugoslavia, I should say, sorry, the Balkans.
Balkans?
Yeah, I said the Baltics, I think, but during the
I
Balkan
understood
conflict.
what you meant.
But just to clarify, and like a lot of people were against that, but there's an argument that could be made that it actually was successful in kind of stopping the conflict. But anyway, Corbyn was getting a lot of well, getting it in the neck a little bit because historically he has voted against missile action, and he would have done so. Well, he's definitely against this missile attack as well. And then Andrew Marr was like saying that you know, without missile attacks and aerial bombardment, ISIS would never have been defeated. So, so
It
his question
really hasn't.
was framed like this. It was like aerial bombardments and missiles stop ISIS. Aerial bombardments are good. You're against good things. Why? That's a paraphrase, but it's kind of general. That was basically
The gist,
the gist
yeah.
of the question. And he goes, "Well, actually, I would say," Corbyn says, and this is, I mean, I'm in complete agreement with him. Like, obviously, you had allied aerial support, but the reason ISIS was defeated was because you had ground troops of Kurds who took it upon themselves and other groups to fight back against ISIS and reclaim parts that had become part of the ISIS state, you know. And when the news was in the media only a short while ago, it wasn't, you know, when ISIS is on their last legs, people are talking because of the ground troops going in and fighting them hand to hand in the streets and everything. So, like, and it's not aerial bombardments or cleaning up after it either. It's going to be like troops from, you know, in Iraq, police force in Iraq, people in Saudi Arabia and other countries as well. So, like, it's a conflation of two very different things, I think, you know, ISIS and this response to the Syria chemical warfare attack or kind of drama that's been happening. I thought it was a very strange interaction, very strange line of questioning, and Jeremy Corbyn did very well, I think, to kind of reiterate, as I said to you yesterday as well, that you know, there has to be more accountability. You know, this has to be passed through Parliament, and also as well, if missiles are fired, that later the sites can be investigated and you can see and quantify the damage and perhaps also even the collateral damage and to see what exactly has happened before and after the attacks as well. But I don't know. Anything you want to respond to there?
No, I mean the problem is, you know, if decisions, if these kind of decisions were always made, you know, following like humanitarian reasons, whatever. But the thing is, like, it's very hypocritical because many things like go on where either vetoes are involved and then, you know, things don't get through, or basically things are going on and then they just blatantly ignore them and then essentially when it suits them. Politically, they decide to act.
Well, that's exactly it, because like Jeremy Corbyn made the point that, you know, okay, we might bomb them now for humanitarian reasons, but still things that we export end up in the hands of bad governments. like maybe Saudi Arabia, for example,
or
it's used in British arms, and you know, like other countries
Spanish
are, other countries are complicit in this as well, and weapons used by Israelis against Palestinians, like some of those components are manufactured in Ireland, so nobody is innocent of this. But you know, for example, British weapons can be used against Yemenis, for example. I know we talked about that conflict, but also as well, like, you know, France, Macron said today in the papers that he has. He convinced Trump to send the missiles, but you know, why are they dismantling refugee camps in Calais? Why are they treating immigrants like well, very badly? You know, because
like very badly.
But like, well,
yeah, of course.
I was going to use a swear word there, but
I
like, so I caught myself. But like, the point is, you know, there's no point. You know, this was the classic mistake with the Iraq War as well. Like, you go in there with no plan for the follow up, because like the war is won. Like very quickly, the quagmire of Iraq and Afghanistan wasn't through winning the, you know, about winning the war, because that was done quite easily, but it was just winning the peace afterwards. And like, okay, you bomb these chemical sites, but what's the follow-up plan? And like, why aren't we going to see, and we won't see, better strategies for dealing with refugees coming into Europe from Syria? Because those people, as I probably mentioned in the podcast last week, you know, the BBC podcast have been profiling these people, and they're real people. We've talked about this before, because we went to a couple of exhibitions about this on last year's podcast in season 4 and season 3. But you know, a lot of these people are real victims who have had horrible stories and horrible things happen to them, and then they go to Calais or something, or even other European countries, and they're treated like animals. And then, you know, for humanitarian reasons, we're going to go bomb Syria. And it's just like, okay, it's a very great plan, because it's like easy and fast and you can do it very quickly, but nobody gives a damn another swear word almost coming there, nobody gives a damn about really like fixing the problem long term. So like, this, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn was saying like a political solution has to be made, and this is very true, because like, people forget like as well, Putin like is a monster, but Russian people to varying extents like believe him, and they think he's been persecuted by the West. So if you go and bomb in reaction to something that many Russians don't believe actually happened, you're only going to strengthen Putin domestically and embolden him, like when he acts as an international agent, you know, on behalf of his Russian people, for example. So even though the Russians have done a lot of deplorable things recently, including their poisoning in Salisbury, which by the way Corbyn was very slow to condemn, which was a bad point against him, like, there's no way this can come to a good solution if it's not through a proper political way. And now, of course, as well, like, Putin was like giving out very angrily about how like things didn't follow the United Nations norms and respecting the integrity of other states, which is complete cobblers as well, because like what he did to Ukraine 2 years ago. So you know, a lot of people like talking, you know, double speak out the other side of their mouth and being very contradictory, but ultimately he is who he is, and of course has to be taken to task, has to be held accountable. But bombing these things, I mean, it doesn't directly affect Russia. So, I mean, Russia effectively let it happen, even though Fox News would tell you, like, that America penetrated their new missile system, you know. But he has to be ultimately dealt with on a conversational level, you know. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of work. But John Kerry was able to do it. You know, he'd take missiles out of certain countries after years and years of hard work and diplomacy. So there's no reason why, like, this conflict in Syria couldn't be de-escalated with diligent and persistent political work with politicians who actually care about what's happening, you know?
I'm not sure I want to say anything else, because you put that, like, quite... you articulated that quite nicely, and I would just, you know, I would just agree with that. But in the end, what you're saying, I don't think it's possible, because... there's an obvious political interest, because if they were like so fussed about Al-Assad, they would have done something many years ago.
Of course.
And nobody really cared to actually ascertain whether, you know, things that were going on were true or not. Or if they saw that they were true, they just like turned a blind eye. And that's the thing. Because of political alliances and so on.
Yeah. Because he was weaker a few years ago, so he could have been got at a lot more easily, you know, a lot more easily,
yeah,
you say.
Yeah.
But now, like, he obviously is...
Well, the war's been going on for 7 years now,
yeah.
You know? It's ridiculous. Well, that's just, like, how politics go, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, it is how politics goes, because...
Of course.
I mean, I was talking to a Belgian guy yesterday who works in the UN, well, he's an intern, and he was like saying how, because like there's a lot of nuclear weapons in Belgium, which has never been officially confirmed, but also they work a lot with NATO, so they have to be very pro. Basically, he was saying how their foreign policy can often just be dictated by real politics, and they have to go along with their bigger neighbors, including America, or their bigger partners. So yeah, so what you're saying is you have different interests and you have real politics and all this kind of stuff that does dictate like how certain agents act. But it's a bit sickening when there's a unilateral action taken without any rubber stamping from Parliament. And it's been sold to us as a humanitarian thing, when in reality it really isn't. So, but yeah, this is probably rumble on for a long more, lot more time, and distressing pictures as well. I mean, the horrible things coming through all the time. But
well, you mean the book?
No. I mean the war. anyway, I don't know. So that's just something from the news as well. So you know anything else to add about Syria? No.
No, I think that's enough. But I'm sure, unfortunately, we'll have to keep on talking about it, because...
Exactly. So we'll talk about other things now. We'll talk about happier things. Okay. Some more interesting things. So we've done the hard part first. And now we'll do the kind of easy breezy kind of stuff. So,
okay.
Well...
I'm intrigued.
There's two things. One, there's a Donald Trump podcast. Series, well, not a podcast series, but a Netflix series. So it's a 4-part series about his life, and it's quite fascinating. And also, well, after that, we can talk about Voltaire a little bit, and how your soul is located in your perineal gland, possibly. But we'll start with Trump. Yeah, so if you haven't seen it, I would definitely check it out. It's just we won't spend too much time talking about it, but everything that he is now, he was before. It's just kind of fascinating to see kind of like this contempt for women, his egomania, his attacking of politicians with vicious insults. I mean, if you look at what the words he's using now about, the name escapes me now, but he's all over the news, former FBI director, calling him a slime ball. Well, that was like his kind of modus operandi in the 80s as well. And, you know, like taking credit for things he didn't actually do, developing a fake persona, to talk about himself in the third person, about how he's a great lover, how Madonna wanted to go out with him. Lots of crazy stories, really. But even like Carla Bruni, he claimed that like he had to break up with his girlfriend, that ended his marriage, basically, because Carla Bruni was you know who she is, no?
Of course.
She wanted to go out with him, and he had to upscale, basically. But she's denied all of that, obviously. But then again, she's married to Nicolas Sarkozy, so who knows where her tastes lie or where her boundaries lie. But Voltaire, you know, the funny thing is, actually, I mean, there's so much I could say, but I won't. I think you just watch it, because like a lot of these facts are just really interesting, very bizarre. But you know, we don't have to talk. I mean, for example, he took his mistress and his wife to the same place and put them almost in the same, like, neighboring chalets or whatever. And then, like, on the ski slope, she was like, "I want your husband. He doesn't love you anymore." So, all these kind of crazy things. But a lot of women found him very attractive back in the 80s. So, yeah, I know. There is. Wonders never cease. Anyway, Voltaire, the French philosopher, who actually had his own bizarre domestic arrangement where he, who am I to judge? But he basically lived with his mistress, who was married to another man. And so he lived in the same house as them. They used to study together. And then, like, she gave birth eventually to another man's kid. But by that stage, she was in love with his own cousin, or his niece, I think. So a torrid romantic... kind of interest there, but that's not why I want to bring up Voltaire, though. Just kind of like a segue from the filthiness of Trump to the bohemian lifestyle of Voltaire. You have philosophical feelings or leanings. Do you have any prior knowledge about Voltaire before I launch into this, or have you ever really taken the time to study any of his works, such as Candide or anything like that?
Yeah, well, we study a bit at school and at university, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so what do you remember?
But you can tell me the first stuff.
It's very simple. Like two podcasts ago, We were talking about how, like, we are perhaps superficial people in terms of, like, we don't have a rich inner world. You can go back to that podcast and learn more about that. It's a philosophical argument or outlook on life that, I don't know, you can agree or disagree with, for example. But he, like, in his work is very interesting because I've been reading a little bit about it. He rejected metaphysics in such a big way. And, like, for example, Descartes said, "I think, I therefore I am." Fundamentally, I mean, this isn't, I haven't read this part, but if I understand what they're saying about Voltaire well, it's not "I think, I therefore I am." I see, and therefore it is, for example. So I know that, sounds like very, like, intuitive or very, well, 2 + 2 = 4, but
no, it makes
sense. But yeah, that was a huge basis of their philosophy. Like, if you can see it, if you can observe it, then that's where truth is, and they rubbish metaphysics because it wasn't some kind of, like, magical construct or, like, based on logic or, like, a logical output from your brain and your processing things, because that's what I think, therefore I am. It was Descartes thinking about things and coming to a logical conclusion. They preferred to see something and then have that be their reality, which also links into the podcast from 2 weeks ago as well, because it was all based on our reality being founded on what we're looking at in the moment, for example. What's also fascinating is, like, as I mentioned to you, like, a lot of his books have metaphors like aliens and that kind of stuff. They come down and show the folly of humans and how they don't see anything, but yet how their intelligence is necessary for them to understand the world, for example. So one story called Micro Mega or Mega Micro is literally this kind of, like, contradiction about how we're insignificant but how we need to use our brains anyway to kind of understand the world and make ourselves better. And what's also fascinating is, like, as I mentioned, like, there's some theory that, like our soul was in our glands, for example, and the world, and it's about, like, destiny and free will and, like, God, like, what place does God have in our life and the universe, for example. And a lot of his books were kind of like an articulation of his view of where God was, because, like, if God is so great, why did he make evil? And, like, all these competing ideas. And also, he was talking about how, like, you know, possibly God made, you know, like, if he was perfect, why did he make something else? And then the world probably was the least, he made multiple worlds, and our world was the least worst world, for example. And then they kind of started thinking, well, because God is perfect in his infinite wisdom, we messed up with the original sin with Adam and Eve, and we need sin, so there's good. So evil has to exist for, so good can exist, and sometimes good exists directly from evil as well. So that's how they kind of understood bad things happening and bad people existing in their world. And then, like, subsequent to that, based on this kind of philosophical understanding and also, like, real things in his life that were good and bad and indifferent, as they can happen in anybody's life, he kind of constructed these kind of parables and stories that involved aliens sometimes about, like, the different extents to which a man can be happy. How much he was subject to free will and subject to destiny, and how, like, what life was. So life sometimes was just a series of experiences, and you kind of had to make the best of it, for example. So, and these treatises had a very profound effect on French society at the time. And when he died, he was called the greatest Frenchman of all time. So, yeah. So just beginning the journey into Voltaire, but already it seems like it's going to be an interesting one.
And what made you read about him?
It was on the bookshelf.
All right.
So there.
Fair enough.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes, well, I saw it, and it was. So there. I don't know. I mean, you just pick up a book because you pick up a book. You don't need a bigger reason than that sometimes. So I think we're coming to a close, no? With part 2.
Definitely.
Anything else you want to say?
No.
All right then. Well, roll on. Part 3. That was part 2, and this is part 3. Thank you very much for listening so far. As per usual, this is the part where we plug some things. This week, more our stuff than other stuff. So, podcasting, Of course, you already find it on your podcast app. I've made that mistake again. But for Patreon, Instagram, and YouTube, you can find us under our handle, LARPA Media, and on Twitter, LARPA1. And we'll be doing some cool filming projects this week, actually, to tie in with the stories and the novel. And
it's a special for Book Day next week.
Because next week is Book Day, yes.
At least in Spain.
At least in Spain. What day is it exactly? What's the date?
Next Monday. We are a week today. Yeah.
A week today. Okay, so we can do a podcast.
Today, although today is not today because today is Thursday.
So we can actually do a podcast maybe, live from there, even though the actual... The whole point.
Yeah, from where?
From the book.
From Cervantes' house.
From the Retiro.
It's not a book fair. It's Book Day only.
Oh, okay. So there's no actual. Because I was thinking last year.
When yes.
Remember the guy who was Spanish guy, right? Get this. He's trying to sell me a book about Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Oh yes, I remember that. That's the end of May.
Anyway,
more space.
We won't give anything more like that. Just like you and your report or application form. So. So this has been another podcast. You can tune in next week and we'll be bringing you something about book fairs and associated things. So, you know what to do.
Bye.
Exactly. And good book will be more appropriate now, actually, but I will say good luck.